The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Well, it's no secret that the largest population in American history is heading into retirement. But many people are ill-prepared to face a third of their lifetime, as much as 25 years that you could spend in retirement. Joining me on the program is Professor Wade Fow. He is a professor of retirement income at American College. And Professor, you recently wrote a paper called 8 Core Ideas to Guide Retirement Income Planning. And the first step in that process or a theme is play the long game. In other words, retirement plan should be based on planning to live, because we know that a couple age 65 could spend between 25 years of their lifetime in retirement rather than planning to die. Explain what you mean by that, and what does this entail when you talk about playing the long game?
Right. So, I mean, I think people really understand this idea, but they get caught up in the heat of the moment and sometimes forget about it. So one example of this would be claiming Social Security benefits. And it's very common, about half of the population claims as early as they can at age 62, because they're really thinking in their mind, they're worried that they're not going to live very long, and they feel like they would lose out on their Social Security if they delayed claiming. You can delay until age 70, and if they did that and then died at 68 or 69, they really would have missed out on their Social Security benefits. But that kind of thinking is really planning to die rather than planning to live. And you're not really going to be all that much worse off if you delay Social Security. And I mean, you are worse off because you die early, but in terms of your financial picture, that will be a less expensive retirement. It should financially have worked out okay. The issue is really, if you do end up living into your 80s or 90s, then you really have a lot of efficiencies if you start early by thinking about long-term strategies, strategies that may only pay off if you do live a long time. Putting that kind of groundwork into place that can really help you to enjoy a better retirement throughout.
Professor, why do you think it is? I've interviewed Yolanda York from Social Security here on the program, and she has pointed out the same statistic that the average American starts taking benefits at age 62, which is a reduced benefit versus waiting to, let's say, full retirement age or even allowing it to accumulate to age 70. Why do you think that is? Is it a lack of education, or they're not working with an advisor? Is it simply not knowing the facts?
Yeah, I think in the past it was partly a lack of education. And actually, in the last couple of years, you can start to see a slow change in the trend where there are people delaying. But it's partly a concern that Social Security is going to disappear, so you should get whatever you can out while you still can. And I think that concern is overblown. Part of it, I think, is just this short-sightedness that people are not playing the long game. They're just thinking, well, why would I give up some money today? And the reason you might do so is because over the long term, it could really benefit you, but it's not going to benefit you for quite a while. And I think that short-sightedness really becomes a big issue as well.
Let's talk about one of the second themes in long-term retirement planning, and you call it, do not leave money on the table, because the holy grail of retirement income planning is finding strategies that enhance retirement efficiency. What should be done here? And explain that term, do not leave money on the table. I mean, does that mean die with no money left in the estate? Explain that.
No, that's not really what I had in mind. That's more just looking for efficiencies. I started my career as an economist, and for an economist, if you have two goals, goal one being meet your spending goals in retirement, goal two, preserving liquidity, if there's a strategy that allows you to spend more but still keep the same amount of assets left in your portfolio, or otherwise you spend the same amount but can have more assets left over, then strategies that allow you to do that, or to even combine the two, be able to spend more and preserve more assets, those are defined as more efficient strategies. And there can be opportunities where it's just a matter of doing things that otherwise you're leaving money on the table. So for individuals who are not super wealthy, there's the issue that in retirement, you can have more than $90,000 of total income before you leave the 15% tax bracket. And so any sort of capital gains you have as a part of that, around $96,000, is going to be a 0% tax rate. The capital gains tax rate is 0% until you leave the 15% tax bracket. So if you're retired, you no longer have labor income, maybe your Social Security benefits or other income sources add up to $50,000 or $60,000, for example, you then have that capacity to have $30,000 or $40,000 of capital gains taxed at a 0% tax rate. And if you don't take advantage of that, it disappears. And that's what I mean about leaving money on the table. Pay your taxes at a 0% tax rate now instead of later having to pay at a higher tax rate.
There are a number of things we talked about there, and this relates to, I guess, a third theme that you emphasize here, and that is use reasonable expectations for portfolio returns. And I know historically, if you look at the stock market, you know, over the last 100 years, it's returned almost 100%, but that includes dividends reinvested. Today, Professor, we live in a zero interest rate world. In fact, in many parts of the world, it's a negative interest rate world. We've seen, for example, in 2015, the stock market go nowhere, or for that matter, from 2000 to 2013, the stock market went nowhere. So what is a reasonable rate of return in terms of expectations when you want to realistically plan your retirement? I mean, what figures would you use?
Well, on the stock side, it is a lot more controversial. The discussion's actually a lot easier on the bond side because bonds, there's just a mathematical formula that based on today's interest rates and the future bond payments, you can figure out, well, if you hold the bond to maturity, today's yield is going to be its return. And one of the biggest pet peeves I have is a lot of the financial planning software out there that people are using, the Monte Carlo simulation type software, the assumptions it uses for the financial plan are to just plug in the historical averages and then have volatility around those. But that means you're plugging in intermediate-term government bonds, for example, 5.5% or 6% returns. And that's really mathematically impossible when you're starting from this situation where even 10-year treasuries now are under 2%. If interest rates go up, you have capital losses on bond funds, or if you sell the bonds before their maturity date. The only way you could have returns higher than today's interest rates is to have interest rates continue to fall, and they can only fall so far. So a lot of the software, unfortunately, is plugging in, say, 3 or 4% higher returns on the bond side than are just mathematically feasible. And that should also impact the stock side as well, because if bond returns are lower, you need to expect stock returns to be lower as well, or otherwise the premium that stocks earn above bonds would be higher. And I haven't seen any compelling argument about why stock returns would be higher in the future. Most of the issues around stock markets do seem overvalued. If anything, we should expect lower returns rather than higher returns. The reason it matters more for retirement than for pre-retirement is the market returns over the next few years are the key market returns that will matter for a retirement plan. For someone who's still, say, 30 years from retirement, today's market returns hardly matter at all. It's going to be the market returns 30 years from now that matter. And so they can get away with using these historical averages to guide their simulations since it really doesn't make much difference. But for people at retirement, it makes a big difference. And it really impacts something like the 4% retirement spending rule. If you plug in the historical averages, it gives you a 95% chance that it will work. But if you do some sort of adjustments to reflect the lower interest rate world that we're in, you may see success rates closer to 70%. And then it's clearly not as safe as people have been led to believe.
Yeah, because, I mean, you take, for example, Professor, somebody that retired, let's say, in the year 2000. We had just come off double-digit returns in the stock market in the 90s. We had interest rates that were at 5, 6, 7% back then. Just think if you went into a bond fund and saw your dividends decline over the next decade, or for that matter, two bear markets in stocks where stocks lost 45% of their value. Those kind of statistics were not modeled into most financial planning software. I mean, they use historical returns of 10% on the market. And even here in my own state of California, CalPERS is still modeling 7 and 8% returns on their pension when there's nowhere near that kind of return in the markets today.
Right. Yeah. Pension funds tend to have too high of estimates as well. And it's basically the same problem. All this software out there, all this advice is assuming higher returns than are really mathematically feasible, at least on a sustained basis, when you are in such a low interest rate world. And if you assume a higher return, it makes you think you can spend more, and that can get you into trouble because you spend more today in anticipation of getting higher returns to justify that higher spending. And when those returns don't come, you've got to make a bigger cut to the spending in the future to get back on track.
So let's go to your fourth theme, which is be careful about plans that only work with higher market returns. I recently just took on a client who had a financial plan that was based on these historical high returns, and obviously it didn't take into account what happened in 2008, or for that matter, the 0% interest rate environment that we've been living in for almost 7 or 8 years. So what does a person need to be cognizant of in terms of these kind of plans, and are there plans out there that are more realistically adjusted? I mean, we use more realistic figures. We adjust our own planning assumptions on inflation, bond returns, and stock market returns that kind of reflect the reality in the world that we live in today.
Right. And if your plan can work with lower return assumptions, then you have a more robust plan that can deal with these types of issues. If basically the only way your plan can work is to get a high market return because you have to spend a lot relative to your assets to make the plan work, then you're really at that point just rolling the dice and hoping you actually get those high market returns. I mean, the difference between Monte Carlo simulations and a spreadsheet, if you're just building the plan in a spreadsheet, with the Monte Carlo simulations, you are getting the volatility, but with a spreadsheet, if you plug in the historical average returns, even if that's right, ignoring this other issue I've been talking about the impact of low interest rates, even if that's right, you still, at that point, only have a 50% chance for success because it's the average return. Half of the time it's less, half of the time it's more. And that's still jeopardizing the plan. I use the term amortizing the upside. You spend more because you assume you're going to get a high return in the future. So you're spending some of those future returns today before you get them. And that really just leaves you vulnerable if the plan's not going to work, if you don't get those higher returns. And so you are taking a lot of risk with that. And for some people, that might be fine to take that sort of risk, but certainly not for the typical retiree who's more vulnerable to their standard of living being impacted by market volatility.
And this comes to a fifth point that you bring up, which I think takes into consideration the kind of environment that we're living in today, and that is building an integrated strategy to manage various retirement risks. Because when we think of risk, we think, okay, stock market fluctuating. But retirement risks today include longevity because people are living longer. I mean, if you take a look at Social Security, when it first was put into effect in 1933, the average lifespan of a male was 65. Today, it's closer to 85. So there's longevity risk. There's market volatility. There's macroeconomic risk. There's inflation. And then also, Professor, there could be spending shocks that can derail a budget, especially in the latter years, where you're more likely to spend more money on health care, medical care, or God forbid, long-term care.
Right. And these are fundamentally different types of shocks, the longevity risk, the market, macroeconomic type risks, and then the spending risks. They're different in their natures and they require different approaches to manage them. And that's where this building an integrated retirement strategy, you need to have some part of your balance sheet that's meant to deal with the market risk. You need something on your balance sheet that's designed to deal with the longevity risk. And you need something in your balance sheet that's designed to deal with unexpected contingencies for long-term care costs. For some people, end up being zero, but for someone who has a prolonged stay in a nursing home due to dementia or Alzheimer's, at the extreme, it could cost more than $1 million. And those are the types of contingencies that you need to have an integrated strategy that has something built in to deal with all these very different types of risks. It's not just market risk or market volatility. There's more to the puzzle in retirement.
Yeah, I think one of the things I've seen often ignored in most retirement plans is medical expenses. You know, I've read studies, depending on whose study you're reading, that the average couple could plan on shelling out anywhere from $230,000 to $250,000 out of pocket for medical expenses during their lifetime in retirement.
Yeah, and usually those estimates are the average. So there's a lot of variation around that number. But yeah, the average out-of-pocket expenses could be in that ballpark range, definitely.
Well, let's move on to your sixth theme, which is approach retirement income tools with an agnostic view. And I'd like to bring this up because if you watch cable television, you have two points of view. You have commercials saying that annuities are bad and they're the worst thing for investment. And then you have other commercials that are saying that these are wonderful tools that can help an individual in retirement. And you talk about that usually the financial service profession is divided into two camps. One camp is focusing on investment solutions, and the other one is focusing on insurance solutions. Explain how to bridge the gap between the two and take a more an objective view to a solution.
Yeah, there's the old saying that if the only tool you have is a hammer, then everything looks like a nail. And that's kind of the issue. People on the financial services on the investment side, the only tool they have available is investments. So the solution for everything is build an investment portfolio for it. On the insurance side, people only selling insurance, the solution for everything is build an insurance solution. But it's the integrated strategies that time and time again in the research I've done show to be the most efficient types of strategies, that you combine insurance and investments, you get the downside protection, you get the stable income from the insurance and the longevity protection, and then you get the upside growth potential and the ability to try to manage inflation risk and that sort of thing from the investment side. And by putting the two together, it really makes a difference. You can get more efficient retirement outcomes. And the simple way to describe this whole process is rather than having a retirement portfolio consist of stocks and bonds, I think the more efficient type of solution is stocks and income annuities. That income annuities replace bonds in the retirement income portfolio, because income annuities, this is like a single premium immediate annuity, they're not a very big part of the market, only about 4% of annuity sales, and it's the very simple lowest commission version of an annuity, but it's invested in an underlying bond portfolio, and it provides payments linked to your longevity. So the longer you live, the more expensive your retirement, and the more income you receive from the income annuity. It's a much more effective, quote-unquote, bond for retirement income. Again, the simple way to bridge the gap is instead of thinking in terms of, well, not thinking in terms of just annuities, not thinking in terms of just stocks and bonds, but stocks and income annuities for retirement.
You know, it's amazing because, Professor, at one time, most corporations, and well, the government still does, had something called the defined benefit pension plan, which was really a form of an immediate annuity. And even though corporate defined benefit plans have been replaced by contribution plans, that was a stable form of retirement where you knew that you were going to get a check. You knew what that check was going to be. It was always there. It didn't go down like a bond fund when interest rates came down, and it was dependable and predictable. And that's why, at least in your work, and I've seen studies as well done by others that are saying that this is a very viable tool in today's environment.
Yeah, I think so. And sometimes you hear the argument that in a low interest rate world, it's a bad idea to get an income annuity. But I think the opposite is really true, because in a low interest rate world, for somebody who's already retired and having to spend their assets, the mortality credit component, the idea that the reason income annuities work is because you're basically contributing to a pool and accepting the idea that if you don't live long, your principal will subsidize those who do end up living longer. And when you don't know which group you fall into in advance, that can be a good deal, because then everyone gets paid like they actually live to their life expectancy, rather than having to assume they're going to live to age 95 or whatever the case may be, and spread out their assets further. And so that pooling aspect becomes all the more valuable in a low interest rate world. Because with bonds, you are getting no interest income. With the annuity, you're also getting very little interest income, but you're getting these mortality credits that can be very valuable in the low interest rate world. And so, yeah, that's how you get that longevity protection and get that stable floor of income for retirement.
Your seventh point, which is start with a household balance sheet. I mean, anybody that's in the financial business, if I was analyzing a company to invest in a stock, I'm going to look at the financial statements, which includes the income statement, but also includes the balance sheet because I want to know the financial health of a company. You say a retirement plan should begin with the balance sheet. Explain what you mean there and what's important to derive from that balance sheet. Obviously, it's a snapshot of what your net worth is, your liabilities, and the assets that you have to work with.
Yeah, so for the household balance sheet, the assets and the liabilities I think of as basically any type of financial goal for retirement. And a lot of these will be streams of spending that you want to do over retirement, so you need to take the present values of everything. But your fixed expenses in retirement, basic living needs, taxes, debt repayment, discretionary expenses, travel, leisure, and so forth. Contingencies, so what are you going to do to deal with long-term care, health care, and that sort of thing. And then any legacy goals as well. Those are the liabilities. And then the retirement income problem is really about rearranging or repositioning your assets in such a way to match them to these different types of liabilities and to match the risk characteristics. And so these assets, human capital, it's if you are going to have part-time work or some kind of continuing work in retirement, that's your earnings from working, your home equity, your financial assets, the checking accounts, brokerage accounts, retirement plans, IRAs, 401ks, and so forth, any insurance or annuities that you hold, and then also social capital, which is things like your Social Security benefits, your Medicare, any of those defined benefit pensions for those who still have those, and also family and community support. And how do you just, you got to then think about how to match those assets to the different liabilities and make sure you've got something in mind for how to cover all the different liabilities in your retirement.
And that includes, once again, going back to the two philosophies on retirement planning, one an investment approach, one's an insurance approach, is to make sure that those longer-term issues that come about with longevity, like medical expenses, are taken care of. Let's move on to your final point, and that is distinguish between technical liquidity and true liquidity. Explain what you mean by that for our listeners.
I think there's an important distinction here about liquidity. So, for example, suppose someone believes in the 4% rule for retirement and they want to spend $40,000 plus inflation and they have $1 million in their investment portfolio. Do they have any liquidity or not? Well, in some sense, you could say they have $1 million of liquidity. They can rebalance their portfolio and so forth. But I think in the truly meaningful sense, there's no liquidity there. Because basically, you have to earmark that entire $1 million to cover the $40,000 spending objective. And you could spend that money on something else, but doing so would risk jeopardizing the ability to meet your spending goal throughout retirement. And so in that regard, you don't have true meaningful liquidity there. How might you get some true meaningful liquidity? Well, the part of the idea behind the 4% rule is you have to assume you're going to live a long time, well beyond life expectancy. A 30-year retirement for a 65-year-old, it's not so conservative anymore, but when that 4% rule was developed, it was meant to be conservative. There was a pretty small probability of living longer than 30 years, and that's the way you're managing that longevity risk, by having to spend conservatively, and that eats away at your potential to have this liquidity. The way to have true liquidity is to pool some of that longevity risk, get the higher payout rate from the income annuity, and then though the income annuity is not liquid in the sense that you can't rebalance it or whatever you want to do, it's now locking in part of your assets to cover your spending goal. Set that aside, and if you could buy that annuity to get that $40,000 of income for, say, $700,000, and you probably wouldn't want to annuitize this much in reality, but for this simple example, then you still have this $300,000 left over, then you could say that that $300,000 has true liquidity. It really is liquid in the sense that it's no longer earmarked for meeting a particular goal. You can then use it for what you want to. And that's the idea of true liquidity.
So, given where we are today, Professor, we live in a world where we're seeing throughout much of the world, like in Europe and Asia, we're seeing negative interest rates. We have low interest rates here. We've had two bear markets. So a lot of the assumptions that are built into a lot of retirement programs aren't necessarily true in this kind of environment. We have the issue that people are living longer today than, let's say, in the past. And then we also have a division within the financial service industry, as you pointed out. One side looks at investments as the sole means of creating a solution. The other side focuses on insurance. How do you create a balance, or how does an individual walk away with knowing that they have the best kind of plan that takes into account different forms of risk, longevity, all the things that one is likely to face throughout a 25-year retirement period?
Well, I think that can still be a challenge. It's really only been the past 10 years where financial planning has started to recognize that retirement income planning is different from traditional wealth management. And for example, CFPs learn about the main financial planning designation. They learn about retirement planning, but it's all about pre-retirement, different types of qualified plans for saving for retirement. Retirement income is still new for a lot of people, but there is training out there for advisors. The American College, for example, has the RICP designation now, Retirement Income Certified Professional, that's teaching advisors about retirement income and how to build these types of integrated comprehensive strategies to manage all these different retirement risks while trying to also meet different goals at the same time. And working with someone like that, I think, can be an avenue forward. Someone who ultimately, there's a lot of different ways that financial advisors get compensated. And really, there's no good method that purely is going to work for retirement income at this point in time. Advisors who are traditionally thought of as being independent, fee only charging their clients, not receiving any sort of commissions or anything, well, they have an incentive to keep the financial portfolio as big as possible, and that's not in the best interest of someone trying to sustain income for their lifetime. And of course, on the purely commission-driven side, that's not necessarily a working model either. So there's still going to be some upheaval and turmoil as we figure out how to do what is the best way to serve individuals for retirement income, and to make sure they do have strategies that integrate insurance and investments. And it's the advisors who are willing to draw from both who I think are ultimately going to be able to most serve their clients.
Well, listen, Professor, if our listeners would like to find out more about the articles and the things that you do in retirement planning, being a specialist, and read some of the articles as the one we just discussed, how could they find out more?
I have a website. It's all one word, retirementresearcher.com. And everything I write tends to be posted there as well, in addition to wherever else it shows up. And so that's the great place to check first.
Well, listen, Professor, I want to thank you for joining us on Lifetime Income. All the best, and come back and talk to us again.
Okay, my pleasure.
Interesting, the conversation you had with Wade Fowle, because it was the same as with Robert Merton. They were both emphasizing focus upon income as your metric for planning everything else.
You've got two schools of thought within the investment field. You have the investment community that says, look, investments are the solution to everything, to anything you need in retirement. Then you have the insurance industry that says, no, you know, you need to have guarantees and insurance. And really what you need is a balance or a merger between the two. And in this case, that's what this couple wanted. John wanted something that was predictable. He didn't want to go through another stock market downturn and be impacted by a severe loss of assets, nor did he ever want to be impacted by seeing his income decline each year, as so many people have seen, as a result of financial repression and where interest rates are today. And think about the next recession. If we actually get to negative interest rates, don't think that can't come here. It happened in Japan after two decades of almost zero interest rates, and it's happening now in Europe with the European Central Bank last week making negative rates even more and increasing the amount of QE to 80 billion euros per month, almost just like what the Fed was doing when it initiated QE3. Interesting, John, how this world is really turned upside down when it comes to retirement planning. I compare that to today. what we're doing today compared to where I got into the business over 35 years ago when people were walking out with defined benefit pension plans, Social Security, cost of living increases were going up 6-7%. I can't tell you the number of clients that were back then telling me, yeah, I'm making more retired than I did when I was working, and my take home's better because I'm not paying that 7.65% Social Security tax. So different world that we live in today. Well, speaking of a different world, we have a different time and we've run out of time, unfortunately. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.